Hello and welcome to the Sonic Cinema Podcast. My name is Brian Scuttle. Thank you for joining me at www.sonic-cinema.com as well as the Sonic Cinema Podcast YouTube channel. Click subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts, whether it's Apple, Good Pods, YouTube, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts, you can click subscribe, rate, and review. It's always appreciated. You can also check me out at patreon.com/SonicCinema. There you will find Life Soundtrack, Leaving the Collection, early access reviews, and more. And it's always kind of a grab bag. I'm still gradually starting to get Leaving the Collection and Life Soundtrack back on a regular basis, but hope to be doing that soon. That's at patreon.com/SonicCinema. So earlier this year, I decided I wanted to continue a series that I did in 2019 called Class of 1999, where I basically look at films from the 1999 movie year. This time though, instead of the filmmakers, friends, and fellow critics that I had on before, I wanted to bring on some new voices whom I've gotten to know in the years since. And our guest today is certainly one of those, Robert Yass Jr. He's the producer of Crooked Tables Productions and podcasts like Close Watch and Franchise Detours. Robert, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Brian. Thanks for having me.
How is everything going over at Crooked Table? I know Franchise Detours has been pretty busy this year.
Franchise Detours this year has been pretty busy. Yeah. So in 2024, we've done the Three Flavors Cornetto trilogy. We've done the Elm Street films, which share a director that we'll be talking about in a few minutes here, and the Deadpools and the Rockies. So it's been a lot of fun over there. Close Watch has been more on a hiatus, but I have in the last year, since the last time we talked, started a podcast with Darren Lundberg of Nostalgia Cast called Back to Bluey, where we talk about that animated series. So that's been a lot of fun and kind of a different type of podcast than I have a lot more experience doing. So definitely people should check that out as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you and Darren are always fun to talk to. What was it that inspired you to start that podcast and discuss that series?
Well, Darren and I are both dads, so we stumbled across the show in our own households. And then I think both of us saw, like, it resonated with both of us because we often talk about how that show is aspirational, how it kind of shines a light on, you know, what it's like to be a parent and what it's like to be a kid and the complexities of that dynamic. And in 7-minute chunks, it touches on these, like, profound themes and messages in a lot of episodes. And so, just like half jokingly, he was mentioned one time, like, oh, we should do a Bluey podcast. And I you know, you don't dangle a good idea in front of me and not expect me to jump at it. So that kind of came a running thing. So necessarily this Bluey podcast, like, when is that happening? And so we kind of, from late 2022 up until, like, you know, I think December 2023 is when the show, when we do debut the first episode. It was like a year kind of back and forth. All right, are we really going to do this? If we do, what would it be called? Well, if we want to do it right, we want to, like, personalize it. And so it just took, like, you know, one of those things simmering in the background while life and other creative pursuits were ongoing, that just sort of came to fruition at just the right time. Because I feel like when our show debuted, it's around the same time that show sort of hit critical mass, and it just, like, exploded in a way that we hadn't really seen before. It was more of a slow burn those first couple of years, like throughout the pandemic, and then just like the latter half of last year, early this year, it's just now everywhere.
So is each episode a sort of an episodic review, or how is the structure of that
right
podcast?
So normally we talk about one episode of the show per episode of our show, and we alternate who picks the episode. So, you know, there's three seasons. Each season's like roughly 50 episodes, so there's 150 options on the table. We are, as of this recording, like the 20-something episode of the show, because we release them bi-weekly. And so it's a Darren pick and then a Rob pick. And we've now, this season, because we're in our second batch of episodes, so our season two, technically, we've started bringing in guests. So we've had our first guest on at this point. We're looking at a couple other ones for this season. And those episodes are structured a little differently. It's just kind of getting a different perspective, what the guest experience is with the show, what it means to them, what are some of the things that resonate with them particularly. But it's really like kind of dissecting each episode, what it has to say, why it matters to us as parents. And it's been really fun. It's been really, you know, that show has a tendency to turn sort of heart-wrenching on a dime. And so it's been really fun to analyze the structure and the storytelling of that, of the series, because the episodes are sort of multi-layered, that if you're watching it just kind of as ambient background noise while you're, you know, while you're watching your kids, it might not hit you the same way than if you give it a couple of rewatches like we normally do before we record an episode, and you kind of dig deeper. And so that's really been the purpose of each of our episodes. And it's been really fun and really positive experience so far.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, check that out, especially if you're a fan of the series. And if you're a fan of Robert and Darren in general, they're a couple of terrific podcasters. I always enjoy talking to them. And I'm really looking forward to talking to you about today's movie, which when I suggested having you on for Class of 99, I basically gave you a rundown of all the movies that we had already touched on in this series. And you gave me a couple that you wanted to do. And this was one that I was definitely interested in talking about because I actually haven't seen it in 25 years. It is Rennie Harlan's Deep Blue Sea with Saffron Burroughs and Thomas Jane, Samuel L. Jackson, Michael Rapaport, LL Cool J, Stone Skarsgård. It's a pretty wild movie. What was it about this one that you wanted to talk about? And why did you pick it, I guess I should say?
Yeah, so there are, I'm pretty sure I might have seen this in theaters. I'm not 100% on that, but I definitely, this is one of like three DVDs that were the first DVDs that I ever got. It was this, Man on the Moon, which I've covered on Close Watch, what used to be the Crooked Table podcast, and Martin Lawrence's Blue Streak. And that was like, those were the first DVDs I owned that I remember owning. I'm sure The Matrix was in there somewhere as well. And, you know, that technology at the time blew my mind. Like the trailer and the music video and the making of, like all this stuff in one place. Because as people that grew up with mostly VHS in your house, in their households will remember, that was not the case. It was, you got the movie and that's about it. You had to deal with tracking and all that other stuff. Be kind, rewind. So the DVD technology, this movie really kind of is the foundation for me in that regard. Plus, this is also the kind of movie that I saw a lot. Like growing up with my family, like we watched a lot of comedies. We watched a lot of like action thriller movies. And that was like Happy Gilmore was on a lot in our house. The Stallone and Schwarzenegger movies were on a lot growing up. So this is like, as a sci-fi action thriller, this is like right in the wheelhouse of the kind of thing I grew up watching. And it had been a while since I've seen it as well. It's probably been at least 15 years or so since I've watched it. And I remembered it being really kind of a fun, interesting take on it. And like you mentioned, a surprisingly stacked cast now going back and watching it.
Well, I mean, I feel like that's probably the Rennie Harlan part of it. Cause, you know, he directed Die Hard 2. He directed, one of the Nightmare on Elm Street, as you said.
Yep.
He also directed The Long Kiss Goodnight, which I think was his, previous film to this one, which even though it wasn't a huge hit financially speaking, it certainly gained a cult following over the years, and it's a fantastic film. So yeah, I mean, I think Rennie Harlan might have been part of it. But I mean, I think to a certain extent, you're also looking at some of these actors starting to being cast sort of at the right time in their careers.
Absolutely.
Like, I mean, you know, this was post Pulp Fiction, post Jurassic Park, Samuel Jackson, you know, right as he's going into Star Wars as Mace Windu the exact same summer. And, you know, Thomas Jane was somebody who was kind of on the way up. I mean, he was a few years away from being the Punisher, but he had already done some bit roles and stuff like that. So he was getting up there. LL Cool J, obviously, highly successful rapper in the 90s. Rappaport, a terrific character actor. Stone Skarsgård was starting to get noticed. This was after the version of Insomnia that he was in before Chris Nolan's remake. And it was also after Breaking the Wave. So I think in that respect, you have a lot of context to why this cast is the way it is. But also, like, with the exception of Samuel L. Jackson, none of these guys are overly well-known actors or really major stars at this point. And I think, you know, this type of movie, it's this the premise of this movie is pure B movie schlock, right? I mean, it's an absurd premise. Like, so the scientist is studying sharks that they've genetically modified to see if their brains have the right makeup to cure Alzheimer's.
That sounds like a messed up
That is an insane
thing.
premise for a movie. And I will say, I do love that they kind of acknowledge that in the movie. You know, it's like, I think this, I will admit, I'm not a huge fan of this movie. I recognize that's goofy, but and it has some fun stuff. I will say I'm glad I rewatched it because of the fact that it reminded me of what I liked about it. And also it's like, okay, there's some pretty decent stuff in this movie. I'm not gonna lie. The one thing I will notice about this movie is that it Harlan just does not let up with the pacing. In this movie, it moves very efficiently for an hour 50-minute movie.
Yeah, it does. And I love that you mentioned in context of Samuel L. Jackson's career, Jurassic Park, because this is in very much in a lot of ways sort of a B movie Jurassic Park clone, but with sharks instead of dinosaurs in a lot of respects. Like rewatching it now is like, oh, this is so Thomas Jane is a proto Owen Grady before Jurassic World happened, only he was training sharks instead of raptors. And so it's like on the scale of B movie blockbuster entertainment, like it feels perfectly at home midway through Samuel L. Jackson's filmography between Jurassic Park and Snakes on a Plane. Like it's like right in that middle ground. It's like playing it's like grounded enough, but also kind of but also leaning into the ridiculousness of its premise, like you said. It's you have the Safran Burrows character as sort of the anti-hero slash villain of the piece, kind of the John Hammond. So it's so there's a lot of that going and is on as well here.
It's interesting about her character because I think anti-hero is a good way of describing her character because I think she has it's weird because of the fact that I think she has good intentions. It's just the way she's going about them is completely deranged. Like, absolutely, like, nobody, why you would do this at all makes no sense to me whatsoever.
Well, they give
But
her a
yeah, I
backstory that like she's
yeah.
witnessed Alzheimer's firsthand, so that's we're supposed to be like, oh,
Oh,
okay.
yeah.
You know,
Well,
everybody
that's
gets their tragic backstory in this movie, essentially.
Well, and that's why I think, and that's why I feel like calling her the anti-hero as opposed to straight up villain is appropriate because of the fact that it's like she has decent intentions and she has understandable motivations for why she would want to do this.
Sure.
It's just the way that she's going about it is completely batshit crazy. You know, and I'm, you know, and obviously Jurassic Park, you can obviously make a beeline from that one to this. And I think that is a great comparison, but obviously we've got to talk about the mother of all shark movies, Jaws.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny that, you know, this and Open Water a few years later, it's funny that people continue to make franchises out of killer shark movies.
Yeah.
And it's like, did you not learn from Jaws?
Jaws the Revenge, Jaws 3D? Like, yeah,
now,
exactly.
Now, what we'll say is that at least these movies, at least Deep Blue Sea, from what I've gathered, kind of goes the slasher route. And it's not just recycling the same characters over and over, right, like Jaws did, which was one of its big issues. But no, I mean, it's funny. And, you know, Samuel L. Jackson's death in this movie is just absolutely one of the most iconic deaths of the 1990s.
Absolutely.
And it's funny because of the fact that I started thinking about it. And to me, I wonder if Rennie Harlan, when he was thinking about how to stage that sequence, he's like, okay, Spielberg didn't have the guts to show Samuel L. Jackson just eviscerated by a velociraptor. We're going to show him get eaten by a shark.
And then the two sharks like converge and pull his head off, I think. They rip him in half. Yeah.
It's insane. I don't know if it's more insane than Stone Skarsgård's death in this movie.
Right.
But it's not far off because of the fact that he's been injured, so they're trying to get him out. The helicopter is lost, so he goes underwater, and then he gets attacked by the sharks. And then the sharks smack him into the glass.
Well, they're smart sharks. They've been enhanced.
And somehow it still seems like he's alive when that's happening.
Yeah. I think he's got an oxygen tank on or something, I guess.
Something like that. But it's like, what? This is, and here's the thing that I do appreciate on rewatch is that there are some absolutely insane kills in this movie. And I like that in the same way I appreciate a good cheesy slasher movie.
Right.
Because of the fact that it's like, look, I know I'm not going to get high art out of this. I know I'm not going to get a great movie out of this. Just kill the cannon fodder in a decent way.
Right.
I mean, you know, at least kill them in an interesting way. And I might actually go along with this movie to a certain extent.
Uh-huh. Did it satisfy you in that way? Like, do you think the kills live up to that criteria?
Oh yeah, definitely. Okay. Yeah, I mean the Samuel L. Jackson one obviously is infamous. But I mean, I'd forgotten about the Stone Skarsgård one, and that was hilarious to watch. You know, and then you have the moment where some of the team is separated, and you know, most of them are together, and then you've got LL Cool J as the chef.
He's in his own movie for half of this.
He's basically in his own movie, and he's got this parrot with him.
Yeah,
and he's determined to keep this parrot safe. And I'll be honest, LL Cool J is my favorite character in the entire movie.
100%.
He understands the assignment when it comes to this movie completely.
Yes,
and I knew he was my favorite character when I first watched it. I was just reinforced how much I enjoyed his character in this movie on rewatch. Like, if the movie had just been about him fighting a shark, I think I would have been down for it.
It's almost like I can imagine an earlier version of this movie where it was Thomas Jane and Saffron Burroughs at the end. but then test screenings be like, no, 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 you can't kill off LL Cool J. You got to make sure he stays alive, especially, you know, he has that meta line sort of similar to Scream 2 of, oh, brothers never make it out of situations like this.
Exactly.
Things like that. Like, you have to, you can't then follow suit with that. I like that you mentioned, obviously you mentioned Jaws earlier, and I think this movie gets that out of the way pretty fast. Like, we have that scene on the boat where we have a group of people like hanging out and partying, and you have the red wine spilling into the water to sort of looks like blood, and it's very sort of slashery vibes right out the gate, and it ends up sort of being a red herring. Like, they nobody gets killed off in that beginning scene. Then you have the license plate that's removed from the shark earlier in the movie, and Thomas Jane hands it to Samuel L. Jackson. I felt that was this movie sort of like, we know, we've all seen Jaws, we have sharks in our movie, we're not doing that, we're doing something a lot less serious and more playful. Did you feel that was Rennie Harlan's intent, and did that come across? Because that's the way I've always read that.
I think the opening definitely, I do think, has Jaws vibes, and I think it really does play into slasher tropes as well.
Sure.
Just because of the fact that it's younger group of characters and stuff like that, and they're behaving like idiots, like a lot of people in slashers do. Mm-hmm. I do think that's definitely the intent. And plus, I mean, Rennie Harlan, as a veteran of horror, as a veteran of the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise, he would understand why those tropes work.
Absolutely.
And so, I do think that was, I do think that was a good choice. And I do like that, you know, as much as obviously Jaws is a progenitor of this movie, I do think the more I think about it, the more Jurassic Park makes the most sense.
Yes.
Because it's corporate greed versus medical research versus, you know, greed versus science. And, you know, you got that in Jurassic Park, you know, versus what you get here. Now, granted, the science in this movie is inherently ridiculous.
As a side effect, the sharks got smarter. You're like, oh, sure.
Yeah, because of course they did. What more do you want to, what is a good idea? Oh yeah, we're going to make the most dangerous predators on Earth smarter.
Yeah.
And it's like,
as you do.
Okay. As one is wont to do for scientific research.
There's also go ahead.
Just to see what happens.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. There's also all the talk of playing God in this movie. There's the whole, and they lay that on really thick. LL Cool J is like praying throughout, and every time, you know, there's a scene where like Michael Rapaport or something like curses about something or whatever, and he's like, oh, he always answers, that kind of thing. And then Stellan Skarsgård has the whole speech about like, oh, you know, no, not his, ours, like our creation. Like, you know, that we've kind of taken over, essentially. And so I think that's also very, very Jurassic Park.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Very much so. I love the gigantic cross that LL Cool J's character has. I mean, that's just such a great touch for his character, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think, you know, this movie, I will admit, I enjoyed it more this time than I did the first time. I really did. So I'm glad, I appreciate it for what it is. And, part of that is 25 years of movie watching, where it's like, I have a better understanding of what I appreciate. I have a better understanding that some movies are just designed to be ridiculous and fun.
Exactly.
And
this is like a mid-budget like action thriller. When do you see that? You know, and everybody on film Twitter is like, oh, those Pirates of the Caribbean movies, they make today's blockbusters look like, you know, like how things have aged and looking back at an earlier time in Hollywood history. And this movie, you know, cost, I think, like 70, 80 million and is like mid-budget. The CGI, it ages okay. How do you feel about the effects in this? I feel like they're solid for how old they are. Like, they're not terrible, but they're not great. They're just kind of sufficient.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I mean, the visual effects don't hold up whatsoever, but I do think to a certain extent that's part of its charm.
Yes, absolutely.
I do think, you know, and the thing is, it's like you see all the time, like there are filmmakers, there are other people who are like, oh, I want to touch up the effects. No. Don't touch up the effects. The reason those effects work is because they were the state of the art, or they were what you decided to do at the time. And I think especially for the tone that this movie captures, which is, you know, a much higher budget Sharknado, essentially. I think this, you know, the effects work. The effects are entertaining. And so yeah, I mean, I think they work well for the way the story is being told.
Even just like the basics of storytelling conventions, like I feel like this movie does that pretty well. You have Jacqueline McKenzie as Jan early in the film, explain like giving all this exposition of like, oh, we're underground and the three levels and blah 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 blah, how all of this works at Aquatica and all of that. Like it's really lays the stakes, the geography of the space that they're in, all of that. Like Rennie Harlan is it has always been a pretty solid action director, and I think that kind of stuff really helps orient audiences so that when the chaos is happening, you'd be like, oh my God, that's right. They're three levels down. There's this many sharks, and like all the basics, you don't have to worry about it. Once the chaos starts happening, it's just like you were saying, it just go, it's go, go, go. They're just running around in water. I kept thinking watching it this time, like how horrible this shoot must have been for these actors, because they're just in like hallways full of water, like week after week. I'm just like, gosh, it must have been exhausting.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. I mean, you know, I think your description of Rennie Harlan as a filmmaker is appropriate. I think he's a solid filmmaker. I don't think he is a particularly great filmmaker. I think when he had decent material, when he's had decent material, he can deliver a solid movie. I think Long Kiss Goodnight is a good example of that. I think Cliffhanger is a good example of that. Cliffhanger is a perfectly strong action movie. You know, yes, it's got that iconic scene at the very beginning, that, and then the rest of it is kind of what it is. But ultimately, I think that movie works. And you know, Long Kiss Goodnight had a much sought after screenplay by Shane Black, and I think it just works like a charm. And it's because it's such a great premise. And you know, I mean, even with Die Hard 2, I mean, he's a filmmaker who, you know, he understood what that movie needed, and it didn't need somebody who's going to try to put their personal stamp on it. He needs somebody to do a sequel to one of the most successful action movies of all time. And he did that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, what do we think of, what do we, I mean, we've talked about LL Cool J. I mean, I know he's far and away my favorite of the cast. What do you think about the cast in general for this movie?
I think it's really solid. I really like all of these actors in here. I think the characters are, you know, they fall right into those type of archetypes that you would hope for in a movie like this. You have the one guy, Michael Rapaport, that knows everything about how the whole facility works. Obviously, you have LL Cool J as Preacher, the chef who's so removed. He's like, I don't understand all that science stuff. Here's my legacy, the perfect omelet, which is made with two eggs, not three. And I really like Thomas Jane. I think he's really fun in this. And this is, it feels like this was the movie that led him directly to The Punisher. Like he has a similar kind of energy already in this film. So I like that my two favorite characters are the ones that survive to the end, because I think that they have really fun chemistry by that in the climax of the film.
Yeah, Thomas Jane is somebody who I think he kind of goes unheralded to a certain extent, and it's a shame because I think he always has brought something to films. And I do agree with you. I think he's solid here. I mean, I think he understands the archetypes that he's playing. I think he understands the tropes that he's playing. And I do like that he seems to be like the other actor in the cast who really kind of understands the tone that this movie is going for.
Right.
And I think he's good in this movie.
He's going for like a Snake Plissken sort of vibe with his attitude. Just like, yeah, exactly. Like shady past, like straight to the point, no bullshit. And yeah, he's got the physicality in this movie as well. All of that. I'm looking at his filmography now and I'm like, that's right. He's been stuck in like direct to VOD land for years, which is a real bummer because he should be doing much more and much bigger things after, you know, especially after movies like The Mist, which he's really great in that as well.
Oh God. Yeah.
Which I feel like shows up like every few weeks in my feed. I'm like, oh, don't show me this again. It's like, you know, you have those prompts online or like, oh, most devastating, you know, final scene. And that's always the one everybody says. but yeah, I feel like there's Aaron Eckhart has a kind of a similar energy. So I feel like they canceled each other out at a certain point because in the like mid late 2000s, they were both sort of popping and then just faded off into the ether in different directions, which is a shame, I think.
Yeah. I mean, and I feel like the comparison to Eckhart's probably a good one. Because of the fact that, I mean, Aaron Eckhart is, you know, he has that kind of mold as far as the same type of character actor.
Right.
But I think he just ended up getting the better chances and working with the better directors. Like the next year he was working again with Neil LaBute and Nurse Spade, but he was also in Aaron Brockovich too. And obviously by 2008, he was in The Dark Knight. But yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. It's fascinating to see the way actors' careers go and how some take off and some don't. And it's really kind of, I mean, I don't know. It's just, I mean, I think... I know it has a following now, but like The Punisher, I don't think did him necessarily any favors.
Right.
Because I mean, it was still studios trying to do a Marvel movie without Marvel's input, and really, with the exception of X-Men and Spider-Man, as we've kind of talked about. Nobody was really getting it at the time.
It was strange times. It was strange times for Marvel. Like, yeah, you had the Sony with Spider-Man, Fox at Fantastic Four, Daredevil. I mean, everybody who's referenced in Deadpool and Wolverine, basically all of those guys. and then New Line with Blade, and then Punisher was with Lionsgate of all places.
Yeah.
And then even when they did the sequel, they just, you know, they brought in Ray Stevenson instead of Thomas Jane and like rebooted it again. So I don't know. I'm also based in Tampa, Florida, which is where The Punisher in 2004 was shot and is set. So that was a big deal to be like, hey, I know that area. I drove by
well, I can't all the imagine. Time.
That doesn't happen a lot in Tampa. So that was a big deal. Like at the beginning of that movie, they flash on the screen, like Tampa, Florida, people are cheering in the theater because they're like, hey, it's our city represented. So I think between The Punisher and Deep Blue Sea, like I've always have a little bit of a soft spot for Thomas Jane when he shows up.
Yeah. Yeah. No, let me try to bring it up here. Let's see what else, if anything. Okay, so I mean, oh well, NCIS LA was, and basically NCIS has been LL Cool J's main thing in the past 25 years. Yeah, he went from LA to Hawaii in that series.
Nice.
He was in Last Holiday with Queen Latifah.
Yeah, LL Cool J has been everywhere. He's one of those guys that just exists in the ether. He's one of those rappers that is has whose personality has transcended hip hop music, like in the way that Snoop Dogg always pops up everywhere, and you're like,
yeah,
what is Snoop Dogg doing here? Oh, of course he is. Lil J's just become one of those guys, like, you know, host television personality and like hosting the Grammys and like lip sync battle and all these different things, like all over the place. And I think, you know, more power to him for having that kind of versatility. Like, he's definitely not somebody who, like, whatever happened to LL Cool J? Like, he's on four different things this week. What are you talking about?
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny because I actually forgot about a lot of these credits. I forgot he was in Any Given Sunday, forgot he was in Charlie's Angels, forgot he was in Rollerball, SWAT, Mindhunters reuniting with Renny Harlin, not the David Fincher Netflix series.
Right.
And then, I mean, last holiday, that was Wayne Wang. I mean, he's not a pretty significant indie filmmaker. I mean, you know, so people clearly recognize that he had talent. And, you know, yeah, I mean, you see him in TV. I mean, he's definitely leaned into more, it seems like he's led more into some hard-boiled roles as opposed to comedic roles, which is a shame because he delivers a really good joke in this movie. Really good jokes in these movies. But yeah, I mean, I didn't realize he'd been on NCIS so long. So
yeah,
that's where a lot of his time's been spent the past 15, 20 years. But no, I mean, I'm glad that I ended up having the reason to rewatch this because of the fact that it's like I may not love it, but I enjoyed watching it, and I think that's sometimes not a bad thing. Like, realizing that it's like a movie is not great, movie is ridiculous, but it was fun to revisit it. So
yeah, and it turned a profit. Like, it made, I think, worldwide double its budget. So it did well enough. It was a solid hit. I just admire now, looking at the sequels, the straight to video sequels that followed, like the restraint that they didn't squeeze out a Deep Blue Sea 2 until 2018, and then Deep Blue Sea 3 in 2020, obviously in kind of in name only sequels, I imagine.
Right.
Just like, other people also studied and messed with sharks, and sharks got
well,
loose.
I mean, it's the same reason so many sequels get made, where it's like, oh yeah, we're gonna just, you know, we're just going to go by this site. We're just gonna go use this IP because people might remember it and stuff like that.
I can't imagine those are any good, the sequels. I mean,
I can't imagine either.
I'm seeing here that Deep Blue Sea 3 has a decent, like, approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes. Read into that whatever you will, but it's like, I would think it would be like not, you know, critically reviled type of stuff. So who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows? I can't speak to the sequels, but I do know that I can't imagine they have a filmmaker like Renny Harlin behind it who can, like, make this ridiculous movie, you know, like, hold it together in the right way.
I can't imagine it either. Now that you got me thinking about this, who are the filmmakers between these two? See, Deep Blue Sea, Darren Scott, I've never heard of him. He's one of those. He's somebody who's done more producing. Well, he's done a fair amount as director. What has he done? I mean, a lot of TV, a lot of videos. Yeah, that's, to your point, not nearly the talent that are well known as Renny Harlin is.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see.
John Pogue, three.
Okay, so he's got some decent scripts to his name. U.S. Marshals, well, he did the Rollerball screenplay, which, okay, never mind. I mean, I've heard decent things about Ghost Ship. So, I mean, there's a couple of things there that are all right.
Yeah.
Oh, he did sequel to Eraser.
Yeah, I'm seeing that.
Probably seems like another in-name only sequel.
Exactly.
Because, yeah, who the heck barely remembers that Arnold Schwarzenegger film?
I remember it.
Charles, I do too, but
Chuck Russell, yeah. Director of the third Elm Street, as opposed to Rennie Harlan, director of the fourth Elm Street. There's a little bit. Yeah. It's a small world. All these Elm Street filmmakers circle around each other.
But yeah, no, I mean, to your point, it's like they seem like they're in name only sequels just to kind of cash in what cachet the IP has.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, you know what? We're not going to try to sell this as an original idea. We're just going to package it as a sequel. And it's like, okay, whatever. But no, I mean, I think Deep Blue Sea is, I think it's funny because of the fact that you think 99, obviously, you think about the significant films. You think about The Matrix, you think about Phantom Menace, you think about Being John Malkovich, Man on the Moon, like you mentioned earlier.
Not Blue
Sixth
Streak.
Sixth Sense.
Blue Not Streak. Blue Streak.
I mean, Blue Streak was an entertaining movie. So, I mean, you've got some entertaining movies there. You know, and the thing is, it's like, I think one of the things that was interesting, this wasn't even the only, like, giant, you know, water predator movie of 99, because Lake Placid also came out, I think, I think the same month. I mean, that was a giant alligator, but the thing I like about the 90s, and especially, you know, and even the early 2000s, is you still had enough variety of, like, the types of movies. Like you mentioned the budget. This was a fairly mid-budget movie. Mm-hmm. Now, like, you wouldn't necessarily make this movie for $70 million now. Like, it would be $100 million at least, and you'd be like, what are you doing with that? But no, I like the fact that you had all these kind of mid-tier movies where just it doesn't pretend to be anything more than it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what ultimately wins me over with this movie.
Yeah. And it's also in the pantheon of killer shark movies, obviously Jaws. But then what else? Like, where would you put this with the likes of, you know, The Meg, The Shallows, Open Water, things like that?
I would say it's comparable to The Meg. I mean, The Meg is a movie that understands exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. Like, it's giant sharks and just absolutely bat crap crazy action. Shallows,
Open Water,
I think,
is a different kind of movie. Now that
Open
I realize it.
Open Water is almost found footage in a way.
Yeah.
It tries to be found footage. It's sort of riding off of that Blair Witch Project type formula.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it's a really interesting experiment in there. I like the first Open Water, but I mean, I would say this would be up there with, like, The Meg, and I mean, The Shallows is a decent one. I mean, even 47 meters below, I think, or 47 meters down is an okay shark movie as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's basically Jaws, and then everything else is just,
well, of course.
It's okay. I mean,
but I feel like if you're doing Jaws by way of Jurassic Park, it's pretty much delivers, I think, on that.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, I mean, I think if you're going to splice those two Spielberg movies together, I mean, I think this is probably as good of an example of that as you can get.
I had to imagine that was the log line when somebody pitched this to somebody, and they were like, Jaws meets Jurassic Park, and someone's like, just saw dollar signs. Green
light.
Oh,
yeah, absolutely.
Make it. And this is what we get. And luckily... You know, like I said, the actors are game and pretty charismatic across the board. It moves at a decent pace. The kills are solid. And like you said, is it the best movie in the world? No, but it's like, that's the thing with 1999, as you alluded to. Like, there are the game-changing movies where there was a seismic shift in cinema. And then there's the ones that feel very much like 1999, like a 90s, like, action sci-fi horror thriller kind of mashup, which is basically what this is. And there's something, I guess to me, there's something comforting in that, in a way, in a movie that I have long-standing personal kind of ties to, as far as you know, moving into DVD market and building my physical media collection and all of that. So yeah, it's a fun watch. It's a fun one to put on. Not particularly deep, but I definitely recommend, if people haven't seen it, to check it out for sure.
Oh no, definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's on. I know it's on Max. That's how I watched it recently. And yeah, I mean, it's a fun watch. Just, you know, and the funny thing is, it's like, at first I was like, eh, I mean, Ray Harlan's not really doing much of anything with this material. He's not really directing it. He's not really bringing a whole lot of style to it. And then as the movie progresses, as the kills start to happen with the scientists, as you start to whittle it down in that slasher form, it's like, okay, yeah, he's gang. He's delivering what you want to deliver here.
Yeah.
And so it was a lot of fun to watch.
And it's pretty small in scale too. They really establish up front, oh, everybody's going home. We have a skeleton crew on the weekend. So you have like your like half dozen characters, and that's, you know, and the, you know, the lady Brenda in the tower who gets taken out by the helicopter. all of that. Yeah, so it does feel sort of like a Jurassic Park feels is more expansive. It's more like Jurassic Park meets Jaws meets Alien, because they are in a relatively confined space with these creatures.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, it's a fun watch. It's, you know, it's worth checking out if you like cheesy shark movies, cheesy horror movies, cheesy sci-fi movies with absolutely insane science. But yeah, no, it was, I'm glad I had the opportunity to rewatch it. Well, Robert, as we wrap things up, where can people find you?
Yeah, you can find my Crooked Table shows, Franchise Detours, and Close Watch wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Good Pods, and other podcatchers, as well as crookedtable.com. And you can find Back to Bluey on all those same podcatchers, as well as you can find Crooked Table on Twitter, Instagram, Threads, at Crooked Table, and at Back to Bluey on Facebook and Instagram.
Okay, excellent. Well, Robert, thank you very much, as always, for joining me. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and looking forward to doing it again in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Brian. This is a blast.
I'd like to thank Robert for joining me on the podcast today. It was always good to talk to him, and look for him again later on in the year for more Class of 1999. That's going to be it for the Sonic Cinema podcast this episode. Got some exciting episodes coming up soon. My annual Dragon Con episode, going to be looking back at the Clerks franchise, and got a lot more of interesting discussions on the way. Once again, subscribe, like and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Check us out at patreon.com/sonic cinema, as well as www.sonic-cinema.com. Thank you very much.